everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another wonderful conversation to empower you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. I just want to say, for those of you who haven't been here before, that I invite you to go to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com. I have some free special reports. I've got lots of articles. You can get archives of my radio sent to you every week. And my Facebook page is a place where I like to post great information, articles, and just stay there right at the leading edge of what's going on. So be my guest. Come and visit and add to the wealth of knowledge. Today we're going to be having a guest I haven't interviewed for quite a while now, and we're going all the way to Melbourne, Australia, to have a very enlightening conversation with Natalie Kringoutis, who is a just such a dynamite traveling all over Australia. She is a bona fide women's health revolutionist, girl after my own heart, and fertility fixer with a big heart for natural health care. She's a doctor of Chinese medicine, an author, speaker, and the founder and owner of the Pagoda Tree. Natalie has stepped up to champion fertility before it becomes an issue with the belief of why wait until it's broken. Nat is helping women in their 20s to lay a gangbuster healthy hormone foundation, knowing that this is the way forward in the world of women's health. Through her blog, she educates women on the benefits of alternative therapies and nutrition for happy hormones. Nat is also the producer and co-host of the online web series Health Talks. She has authored three books, including Fertilize Yourself, Eat Fat, Be Thin, and Eat Fat, Be Lean. And it's such a pleasure to have Natalie on the conversation with us today, because she's always such a wealth of information. So, Nat Kringoutis, welcome to the show today.
Hi, Cheryl. Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's always great to have you on the show, Nat. You have such wonderful information to share. And today we are talking about the area that you are most passionate in, women's health. And particularly I want to focus on helping women to understand more of what is driving conditions like endometriosis, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and, you know, PMS, and even the infertility issue, which is quite a problem for younger women, women in their teenagers, 20s and 30s, what's really going on. So that's an area that you are such an expert in. And let's just jump in. And first of all, let me ask you, how serious a problem are these hormonal imbalances for young women? And why are they a potential problem for their health in the present time, for their fertility and long term?
Yeah, first of all, yes, it is my most favorite thing to speak about, because we see this so commonly come through our doors in not only in the clinic, but, you know, when I am on the road and I am touring, so many young women are finding themselves being diagnosed with conditions like you've mentioned, PCOS, endometriosis, and, you know, the knock-on effect of that affecting their long-term fertility. And it is common. We know, for example, PCOS, around 20% of women are being diagnosed now. That's one in five, which blows my mind, especially given that there's so much that can be done to help support, you know, these women's health, yet the information is severely lacking. And as, you know, you advocate for as well, if we can find the why is this happening, we can start to make, you know, an informed choice to do something differently to see if we can get a different outcome. But, you know, first and foremost, why is it happening? I have to say that for the majority of women, these are lifestyle conditions. They come down to the way that we're living our life, whether it be, you know, environment, diet, lifestyle, emotional well-being, toxicity. All of these things are part of what make up our day-to-day happenings. And, you know, for so many women, it's actually affecting the way that their body is functioning. And so, you know, being able to identify that, I think, is really wonderful, and it makes it far less scary in the long term. But they definitely are on the rise, and you know, I get a little bit worried in the sense that what we're utilizing to treat most of these conditions is the oral contraceptive pill. And, you know, that's not necessarily providing a solution. In fact, you know, you and I know that it's the long-term ramifications of that are pretty serious, and it's definitely not fixing the issue at hand. So, you know, as much as I don't like the pill, it's not about really, it's about information and getting information so that we can make that choice to do something different. And many women are on the pill for that reason outside of contraception. We know it's the number one most prescribed drug across the world, yet, you know, they're not doing anything differently to try and get a different outcome, and they're using that as their magic bullet to, you know, fixing their issues. But what's happening is they're coming off the pill, ready to have children, only to discover that not only is the condition there, but it's 100 times worse than what it was before. And I think, you know, that is very scary and confronting for a lot of women. They're also being told that not to worry about it, that, you know, that there's other magical drugs out there that are going to help them so miraculously fall pregnant, and they're also finding that that's not necessarily the case either. So, you know, it's just getting the information, getting clued up and starting to do some different things, you know, day to day. It's not necessarily what you do in your doctor's office. It's what you do day to day that's going to make the biggest difference, I find.
Okay, so let's start with, we'll go through a couple of these conditions, and you can help us understand what drives them and some of the successful strategies for healing. And let's start with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Let's define it, what it is. How does a woman know if she has this condition? And what have you found to be some of the more effective strategies to help heal women?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing with polycystic ovarian syndrome is typically we know that it is a condition that arises from excess androgens or too much generally male hormone in the body. So, you know, we see symptoms like facial hair, acne, weight gain, missing periods, because obviously the hormones are out of balance when there's too much testosterone. Obviously that pushes out the other sex hormones, your estrogen, your progesterone, amongst other things. We also see, you know, a host of other symptoms I find, like abdominal pain and emotional problems, anxiety, depression, skin problems, thinning hair. There's a big swag of symptoms that we see and use for a from a diagnostic perspective. But what we've also found is that there's this almost new wave of women being diagnosed with PCOS that don't have those symptoms. Yet they're showing, sorry, I should also mention that these women generally have many follicles sitting on their ovaries as part of the condition as well. So what we're finding is that these women that aren't presenting with all these other symptoms, they're going for an ultrasound because their periods are missing, and that's generally their only symptom. And they're finding that they have these, you know, multiple amounts of follicles on their ovaries that are preventing them from ovulating. And so what I've found in my experience is that generally, you know, times have changed. Once upon a time, you didn't have a period by the time you were 15. You know, your GP might say, let's just wait it out for a little bit and see what happens. And then eventually you would be put on the pill. And this is, you know, I'm talking 15, 20 years ago. That was considered the solution. Oh, don't worry, you don't have a period. We'll just put you on the pill and that will give you a menstrual cycle in theory. Unfortunately, we know that's not a menstrual cycle. That is just hormones synthetically tricking your body into something that it's not naturally doing. And that is not either considered a period either. It's actually just a withdrawal bleed from the hormone. So let's just say that these women have been on the pill for 15, 20 years and then they're ready to have a child. They come off the pill and they're, you know, waiting around for their period to arrive. 6 months down the track, they're still not seeing evidence of their hormones starting to do that. And so they go back to their doctor, and this is when they're very often diagnosed with PCOS from an ultrasound and a blood test. You know, unfortunately, I think what's happened, and, you know, times have changed now in the sense that if you were a 15 or a 16-year-old girl, you'd have those tests now to find out whether or not that's the case, whereas prior to that, we were just being put on the pill as a solution. So these women are coming off the pill only to discover that now their body in general is in shutdown mode. You know, the pill has affected their gut permeability, their gut lining, their ability to to absorb and utilize nutrients properly. So, you know, then there's this knock-on effect that they have to start to do the work to restore the back end of the body to get the hormones to start to play the game properly. And that's a big problem, I think, because, you know, like I said, the women are waiting until the point of wanting to have children and then discovering that they have these issues, where this issue's probably been there all along, yet they just weren't diagnosed 20 years ago. So, you know, with these women, we're not seeing the long-term effects showing up as symptoms in terms of things like acne and weight gain and hair loss, or, you know, or facial hair or these sorts of things. We're just more so seeing that, you know, via a blood test and an ultrasound that they've got the condition, or perhaps just polycystic ovaries and not necessarily the syndrome. So, you know, it's been particularly interesting to be involved in women's health at the moment, because we're obviously putting this information out there and women are starting to get a little bit curious. They're starting to do different things, even whilst on the pill, in their transition off, to see if they can get a different outcome. Also, if they do know that they've had that diagnosis of PCOS. So, you know, it is a little bit scary, and I think women can be taken back by that diagnosis, especially if they've been, you know, living the last 20 years on the contraceptive pill. But there is a lot that you can do to help, you know, get the hormones back on track. I think the other really tricky thing with PCOS is that we know that part of the issue is also how the body responds to insulin and insulin resistance. And, you know, it can be really tricky because insulin's there to, basically when glucose comes along, it's there to, you know, help to mop that up, so to speak, and utilize that. But what's happening is that, you know, with these women that become insulin resistant through these hormone conditions, is that they require much more insulin to get the job done. And this can send our hormones haywire, especially testosterone tends to send it through the roof, and this is where we start to see these conditions arise. So, you know, first and foremost, for these women, it's starting to look at, okay, what's my body telling me? What are my signs and symptoms? And going from there, because we are all different. And so, you know, diet will absolutely play the biggest role, I find, for getting things initially back on track, because that's what you're doing on your day-to-day basis. That's what you're eating every day. It's what you're nourishing your body with. And so really getting in there and starting to remove things like, you know, your sugars and your gluten especially, to get your body thriving and feeding your hormones in the right way is absolutely crucial for these women that are showing signs of hormone imbalance. So, you know, if you can start to identify, all right, you know, maybe I've lived the last 15, 20 years on pasta and bread and my sugar cravings are through the roof, all of a sudden women start to get answers as well as to why their cravings are almost bigger than them, and that their body's asking for you know, things that aren't necessarily serving them. So it's starting to get to the bottom of that and making healthy choices in terms of diet and lifestyle. The other massive driver that I find is stress, and we know that stress does set off a chain of reactions in the body that can trigger, you know, our stress hormones that have a massive impact in overriding our sex hormones, and that also becomes a big issue when it comes to PCOS. And you know, typically in the clinic what we find with PCOS is that one of two things happen. Either women's hormones go through the roof, or they kind of don't do anything at all. So, you know, this is what I'm saying too, in this new wave of women that are coming through, very often what I'm finding is that, like I said, they're not showing those common symptoms, and their hormones are being basically, you know, constricted or affected, or almost like a blanket put over them as a result of the stress hormones. And so therefore they're not showing those symptoms, but they are showing signs of PCOS. And so it's quite interesting, because if you can decipher what's going on just from that perspective, you can start to treat the body in the way that it needs. So, you know, if the hormones are really low, I find that, you know, without doubt you need to start with gut health. But these people particularly do need to focus in that area. Whereas if things are all over the place and you've got estrogen shooting through the roof, I find that often stress is the thing that we'll work on, and the adrenal health more than you know, just focusing on the gut. So there's lots of little clues, and I guess piecing it all together is part of anyone's wellness journey. And then there's, you know, obviously testing and getting solid parameters or benchmarks that you can see how your body's tracking with what you're doing, I find that really useful as well, because you can give people, you know, great healthcare advice and they start to implement it, but to see evidence of change, not just alongside of symptoms changing, can be great for some people. Some people need to see that. So the other thing that I bring up in treating hormone imbalance and especially PCOS is liver detoxification, and that's really, really important too, because if your body can't properly utilize, everybody needs testosterone, don't forget, you know, it's not that we are trying to completely rid females' bodies of testosterone. We need that to create our healthy sex hormones. But if our body's not properly detoxifying, or our liver's not properly detoxifying and the testosterone and converting that properly to estrogen, then we're seeing that become a really big issue too. And this is where we see, again, you know, especially environmental influences affecting the way that our bodies work. So, you know, this is when we see that chemicals in our environment start to impact the way that our body is able to detoxify and start to change the way that our hormones are working as well. So I guess they're the three places I get people to start, because they're the easiest. And then, you know, you need to transition into also looking at the emotional side of things, and that being considered another stress alongside everything else that the body has to deal with. And I don't know about you, Cheryl, but I find that obviously is one of the hardest things for many patients, because it's often the driver of the reason why something's happening, potentially that they've, you know, experienced something in their childhood, whether it's been a eating disorder or even just carrying thoughts and feelings that, you know, we establish as young women about ourselves into a later life, which will go on to have an impact also on the way that our cells, right down to the way that our cells work. I think our emotional health is particularly interesting, and it's certainly an area I'm really interested in. It's not my forte, but I totally appreciate how that plays a massive role.
Well, so lots of great information. It's really interesting that you're seeing two different conditions. One is considered polycystic ovaries, which is the ovary producing a lot of these little sacs that contain, you know, immature eggs that in a natural cycle will mature and one will beat the rest out, and that's what ovulation is. But in polycystic ovarian syndrome or polycystic ovarians is that there's a lot of these and I want to just say that when we have a natural cycle, there's a stimulation of these follicles that hold the eggs, and they're all getting stimulated, but one seems to advance more than the others. And then when ovulation occurs and that egg is released, then the message, the natural healthy signaling, tells the rest of those follicles to basically resolve and dissolve and disappear. That's recede anyway. So that's a natural process. But in polycystic ovarian conditions, all these potential eggs and their little sacs start to mature, but they never resolve after there either is ovulation, or in some cases, probably in most cases, that they never really, there isn't one that reaches maturity first and then is released and becomes the egg. They're just all kind of starting to develop but never go anywhere, and they're just like these little round cysts sitting around in the ovaries, and that's really what the problem is, which causes lots of hormonal imbalance. So polycystic ovarian syndrome was the term that was used, as you were saying initially, to talk about a condition that is driven in great degree by insulin resistance. Testosterone, which is too much sugar in our diet can drive testosterone levels, right, to be higher.
Yeah.
Right. So there was always that connection between this condition of polycystic ovarian syndrome related to insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, and the male-like symptoms of acne or thinning hair, like balding hair would be, or infertility or weight gain was attributed to that. And, I mean, that's still obviously a pretty big problem, because we're a sugar-addicted country and countries.
World. You know, world.
Australia, US, and everywhere else. So these kids from young ages are eating tons of sugar, which are having such an impact on hormones. And really, it's like a pre-diabetic condition if it's not addressed. Mm. It's a symptom, really, wouldn't you say, of moving in
Absolutely.
That potential. So, you know, the diet plays such a big role.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, for women that are diagnosed with PCOS, the diagnosis and the long-term effects of that, especially when they're in their GP's office, the news is not, you know, something that any woman wants to hear, no question. I mean, if it gives them answers, and that's the way that we would encourage every woman to be taking the information on, is that you can use that information to move forward. But a lot of women are told that because of that, because they're going to have trouble ovulating, or they might not actually ovulate at all, that they will never have children. And, you know, this is where I say to people, of course, if you don't do something differently, you can't expect a different outcome. That is just your special little warning to start to implement some changes to see where your body takes you. But it's certainly not true that women with PCOS can't have children. There are a lot of women with PCOS that have children successfully, and you know, it is getting to the crux of the issue as to why it's there. But also, you know, what I find with these women is that generally, you know, we can transition their body quite quickly into a regular menstrual cycle, you know, over time, but their regular cycle might be slightly longer than the average. You know, the average cycle, we like to see them around 28 days. Women with PCOS, their cycles might sit somewhere around 35 days. But, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, so long as we're seeing a regular menstrual cycle in the body and the hormones doing what they're supposed to be doing to the best of their ability, then that's obviously the aim of the game. So it's thriving with the, you know, with the conditions that are there, but it's certainly something that you can influence your body to transition to being much more healthy and more regulated, especially when it comes to hormones. And it becomes then a trick of understanding ovulation. Once you start to get that rhythm, that natural rhythm of the hormones working again, you'll find that the amount of cysts or the follicles that are sitting on the ovaries, they're not cysts, they're follicles, starts to diminish as well, and that's a great thing. And, you know, I mean, it's typically 12 or more on each ovary is what they want to see to establish or a symptom that they'll stack up against bloods and everything else to confirm PCOS. But, you know, so long as, like you said, that the follicles are doing the right thing, and there is, you know, say that there was more towards that high end of 12, sitting there, we know that that several sit there, or you know, a reasonable amount sit there, kind of like in a line on the ovaries, and it's kind of like this production line, and they're all sitting there, each one more mature than the next, ready to do their thing. And so long as, like you said, that then once ovulation and that event's occurred, and the rest, you know, do dissolve away, then the body will do what it's supposed to do, and it's certainly what we're trying to get women's hormones to do, alongside herbal medicines in the clinic and acupuncture. We find that very effective. But, you know, first things first, those steps need to be in place with diet and lifestyle, absolutely.
Now, there is some supplements that are becoming very popular here to treat polycystic ovarian syndrome. One of them is a form of inositol. Is that mm-hmm. used in Australia, to use inositol?
No.
Okay, so inositol, just share with you and everyone else listening, that inositol is it's a term used to refer to a group of naturally occurring carbohydrate compounds.
Okay.
And what it has been shown, it's a particular unique compound that has the ability to actually reverse the conditions of polycystic ovarian syndrome. There have been some studies that show, because it reduces the insulin response in the body.
Right.
But specifically helping with polycystic ovarian syndrome. And mm-hmm. there's some specific forms of inositol called, one of them is called MYO, M-Y-O inositol, mm-hmm. That's what I would use for someone with polycystic ovarian syndrome. That is a supplement. So studies have shown it's really effective in addressing this insulin resistance. And the other thing that is of interest that shows up with women that I found in research is that Many women have very low levels of magnesium, which is really needed for overall health.
Yep.
Very low levels of chromium, very low levels of vitamin D, and very low levels of omega. So those are key nutrients. And if you're eating a crappy diet, if you're under stress, you're not taking proper supplementation, then how can you ever have optimal levels of those key nutrients that help with the hormones and balance the blood sugar levels, right? You know, it's like there's no chance that that's ever going to be attained.
Exactly.
So these are, you know, these are really interesting things that are driving these hormonal imbalances. It's stress, I think, I agree with you, is the number one hormone disruptor of all time. Because it compromises all these and uses up all those nutrients in the body.
Well, I mean, exactly. That's exactly right. And then, of course, you know, the other thing, cortisol is, you know, obviously one of our stress hormones, and it you know, indirectly will affect your sex hormones as well and the balance of those. So it's this knock-on effect. And, you know, I ask every person that comes into the clinic, how stressed are you? Which is a silly question, actually, because no one ever answers that correctly. Or they say, oh, I think I cope pretty well with my stress. And it's like, well, that's not what I'm asking. But also, what is the driver of the stress? Because stress isn't just, oh, my goodness, I'm rushing around trying to meet a deadline. Stress is eating, like you said, poor nutrients and the body then being compromised and you know, not able to do what it would ordinarily should be able to do with the right nutrients. It can be emotional stress that's lurking in the background, like I said, you know, thoughts and feelings about yourself that you've established when you were 7 or 8. Apparently that's when, you know, by the age of 7 we have established all of that, apparently, how we feel about ourselves, our self-esteem. These things are, and it can be really hard, again, with something like PCOS, because very often you can definitely see that there's a relationship there. Very often there is. These women are overweight. So self-esteem is something that's a big, big issue. And moving past those barriers is very hard, and I get that. So, you know, there's emotional stress, there's environmental stress, it's coming at us from every angle. You know, driving a car is stressful. There's signs, there's people, there's traffic lights. Listening to traffic is stressful. We don't, you know, associate these things as being a stress. But if you think about it, you know, once upon a time we were roaming through, I don't know, deserts and forests and whatever, and there weren't street signs and there weren't aeroplane noise and there wasn't any of these things that were impacting the way that our bodies work. And we have to be mindful of that. So, you know, first things first, one of the hardest things I get, you know, for people that are constantly on is to chill out. And, you know, things like meditation, gentle exercise is really important as well. You know, this is the other thing that happens I see time and time again, especially with PCOS or other hormone imbalance like estrogen dominance, where there is weight gain, that these women will slog it out at the gym at a high intensity and say to me, I'm getting nowhere. I exercise twice as much as my friends, yet I just can't lose weight. And it's like, yeah, because you're actually, it's counterproductive because your body's seeing it as another stress that it has to deal with. Right. So it's knowing what your body needs too, I think is very important. And sometimes when you have these clues, you can try something different and see how your body responds to that. But I definitely find that for women with PCOS, you know, short bursts of exercise are so much better for them than long slogs at the gym.
So let's just to kind of wrap up the PCOS, polycystic ovarian condition or syndrome, and the other thing I just want to clarify what you said that I think is really quite profound. Originally we saw this polycystic ovarian syndrome. It was considered a syndrome, and it was this insulin resistance and all this male hormone symptoms all related to this too much sugar, which drives the testosterone. And now you're saying because women have such a history of being on the pill and stress that has such an impact on their nutritional status or hormonal status, we're just seeing excessive follicles, not necessarily associated with more insulin resistance and all the other symptoms. So this is like another facet of imbalance, which can cause also infertility issues, right? One of the
Absolutely.
Problems.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and Absolutely. And this is the thing, you know, we're very quick to say, oh, that's okay, don't worry, we're going to do IVF, let's say. But if the back end setup's not there, IVF is not really going to necessarily be successful. And, you know, we need to look at why, and we also need to look at the long-term ramifications of assisted fertility, because if you're not set up, if your body's not allowing you to do that, there's a reason. If you're too deficient to have a period, you're too deficient to have a child. So you need to look at what you can do to get your body in optimal working order to be able to move on and show signs of fertility. That's how you know that you're ready to do that. And I know that can be confronting for a lot of women, but it's not ever really spoken about. If you, you know, go to your IVF appointment, they're not worried about what you're eating, if you're smoking, if you're drinking, if you're, you know, not looking after yourself. They're worried about getting you a child. And unfortunately, it's an expensive and emotionally draining exercise that doesn't have a lot of logic when it comes to supporting the body as a whole.
And if women, actually their partners, are not in optimal health before they conceive, then they are passing on compromised genes, compromised functions. Their children potentially will be more vulnerable to health issues. And as you know, I do a lot of nutrigenomic testing, and I see the impact of parents who weren't in optimal health, and that their children have gene issues. They're more software glitches in their genes than their parents, so they become more vulnerable to health issues.
That's right. And we also know that there's, you know, more information coming through. Obviously, you know, someone that has experienced already a lot of stress around not having a menstrual cycle and doing everything that they can to get that back. And if they're going through the regular medical model, they will be, you know, utilizing things like Clomid to try and induce ovulation. So, you know, again, we know these things really rob the body of essential vitamins and minerals. They also strip away the woman's fertile mucus, which is essential for conception as well. So it's a little bit counterproductive. But we also know that there's a lot of research now going into and studies going into babies whilst in utero and especially when it comes to adrenal health, how their adrenals are on from a very, very, very tiny gestation to facilitate the mother through stress. So all of a sudden babies, and I find this quite fascinating, that you know, basically the baby's, you know, releasing what it can to help to support the mother through the pregnancy in terms of the stress hormones. So babies are being born basically with their adrenals already compromised, and that heightens their stress response as well. So these things, when you add it all up, you know, add that onto perhaps being cesarean born, perhaps being breastfed, perhaps then because you're, let's just say potentially your gut and your immune system is compromised just from those things already, you know, you're going to find that child's going to be more unwell. They're probably prescribed antibiotics from a very young age, and that process is repeated. So, you know, their gut health is poor, their stress is heightened, their adrenals aren't fatigued. So no wonder they're not getting a period. You know, that they get to 15, they don't have a period, and we can't work out why. Whereas if we can trace back what's actually happened, we can start to treat this. But I find that that fascinating, you know. Mothers are working and expectant mothers are far more busy now than what they were even 20 years ago or 50 years ago. And I think that there's a knock-on effect of that.
Yeah. So you obviously, as an acupuncturist, see great results when women come to you, get acupuncture, get some of the Chinese herbal formulas, and then make dietary changes and find ways to reduce stress, like yoga or meditation or hot baths or whatever will help them to calm down.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing with Chinese medicine is, I guess what we really try and do in the clinic here is understand the physiology, not necessarily Chinese medicine physiology, but the actual physiology, scientific, you know, what's actually going on within the body, and mesh the two together, because Chinese medicine's phenomenal, but the way I see it is it's like any medicine that influences the body to try and get a different outcome. But if we don't build up the back end, if those minerals and vitamins and the nutrient stores, and if that's not there, then no amount of Chinese medicine is going to actually make a change. So we do use a lot of supplements in the clinic as well. And I do what I can via diet. But, you know, Cheryl, you both know that unfortunately our foods don't contain the nutrients that they once did. And that's part of the issue too, is that we're eating nutrient-lacking food. And, you know, we're always advocating for women to be eating organic where possible. But, you know, for whatever reason, that might not be happening as well. And I don't think we can necessarily rely on that alone when we're trying to fix hormone imbalance. So it needs to be across the board. This approach needs to be taken. And the other thing that, you know, is very overwhelming when women come into the clinic and they've got all this information. They're kind of, you know, and maybe there's women listening today going, I don't know where the heck to start. Like, where do I start? There's a lot of information. And I say to women, I want you to choose three things that you're going to do differently for the next 4 weeks. And, you know, by the time that they've done that, then it becomes a habit by the time I see them next. And I think that's really important, is to give things that are actually achievable so that you can start to see a change. So, you know, I start women and say, all right, well, we're going to remove gluten as one of the first things we're going to start to do, and we're going to introduce bone broth. And, you know, more from a diet and lifestyle perspective, not so much the supplements that we might give them.
Good advice. So let's move on to endometriosis, because this is another really serious condition affecting so many millions of women. And I'd like your thoughts on what you found. Well, you know, why don't we just define what endometriosis is and then share what you have found to really help women with endometriosis.
Sure. Well, the thing with endometriosis is we say we don't know why it happens. You and I might beg to differ slightly, but, you know, it basically is where blood's making its way into tissues surrounding the uterus or even outside of that, and it shouldn't be there. So these cells start to grow outside of the uterus and behave in a way that, in the same way that the uterus would during a period. So, you know, we can start to see bleeding outside of the uterus. We start to see all sorts of complications, and women can experience. I mean, I met a woman that had endometriosis right up into her diaphragm. It can continue to grow and spread. And you know, you and I know that it's anything like that is being fed by something, and typically it's being fed by. I find, you know, xenoestrogens, phytoestrogens, those sorts of things that mimic estrogen in the body that continue to behave like estrogen tend to feed these conditions. So very often these women, they experience excruciating, not always, but most often they experience excruciatingly painful periods. They have quite a clotted menstrual flow. They have a lot of spotting prior to the period. Very often if you palpate the abdomen, there's quite, you know, you can feel the lumps and nodules. I find one of the key, alongside those common symptoms, one of the other key things I look for in clinic is bowel troubles. We know that they very much influence each other, and endometriosis can very often affect the bowel and grow around or nearby. Often these women have fertility troubles as well, because this tissue is growing either inside or outside the uterus, compromising.
And it bleeds, right? It bleeds when
it bleeds.
Women
so
have...
So it acts in the same way as the endometrial tissue. So your endometrium, obviously, each month you get a period, and that's what sheds away. So these cells act in the same way, but they may not necessarily be present inside the endometrium. They start to grow outside of the uterus as well. And it does, it bleeds. So this is why we're getting bleeding outside, and this becomes a big issue. And one of the other common things I see with patients in the clinic is nosebleeds. So that's another indication. And again, it's because we're bleeding, these tissue behaves exactly like your endometrial cells do. So, and the fertility issue, but because the embryo can't attach and embed and then grow in that lining, because it's the tissue is very often compromised or causes a lot of scarring as well. So, you know, it is an issue, so not so much in terms of ovulation like polycystic ovarian syndrome. It's more about this tissue growth that's present within or outside of our reproductive organs. And it can grow in and around the tubes, so that does become an ovulation issue. It's not that the woman's not actually ovulating, though. It's more about the actual the you know, physically what's actually happening inside the body, that there's blockage that can occur in the tube. So it is very painful. And, you know, again, women are told that they will have trouble falling pregnant. Again, I don't, this is not necessarily a definite thing, and we have many women that are told that and go on to have beautiful pregnancies. But it is a condition where, you know, I have to say, again, it's very much lifestyle related, and really the only way to fully confirm endometriosis is via a laparoscopy. You can't, I'm starting to hear of new ultrasounds and new tests that they're doing. I don't know heaps about them, but really there's so many patients that it's suspected, even though it might not look like it's actually in their uterus, it can be outside of that, and that's when it becomes a bigger issue, because it's, you know, it's growing in places, certainly not confined to the uterus itself.
So, you know, this, you know, the research that I've seen has associated this increase in endometriosis with exposure to toxic chemicals, pesticides, herbicides, right? These are, which many, they're so toxic that they're affecting the bodies, the hormones. Many of them are estrogenic in nature. So we have to go and look at exposure to toxins and the environmental toxins, obviously nutritional deficiencies, obviously stresses. Anything else you have seen in your practice?
I think also
inflammation. I was just going to say chronic inflammation. And aren't they now considering endometriosis an autoimmune-like condition?
Yeah. They are, and which is particularly interesting, you know, for you and me, because that makes a lot of sense. And that is, it's chronic inflammation. It is. And, you know, I know that if I can get these patients to remove just inflammatory foods, it makes a massive difference too. So absolutely 100%. There definitely is that they're starting to believe that it definitely is autoimmune related.
Yes, you know, it just brings us back to the realization that what we've been exposed to, what we've been eating, what drugs we have taken, all have their consequences. And there are many variations on a theme. Sometimes where things show up may be directed through various emotional states, because emotions are showing up in our organs and systems. So, you know, that's a component. But the fact is, this autoimmune condition, which is this chronic, overactive immune system response, which is just showing up in so many illnesses. In fact, even cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes is considered an autoimmune condition. Mm-hmm. And as we were talking before we did our interview, this is so much driven by leaky gut, toxic foods, sugars, pro-inflammatory. You know, we are just seeing many variations on the theme, and hormonal systems are so delicate that when we start bringing in toxic substances into the body in an unrelenting manner, the first sign of things to go awry will show up with our hormones.
Yeah, and it is. It's an intricate balance, and your body's clever too, in the sense of, it's protecting itself. It's trying its best to protect itself anyway, even though it can be, like, you know, hard to understand that, but it's doing its best to do what it can within its means.
And you know, if it's just treated with the pill, for instance, and you went over this really well earlier on in our conversation, but it's worth repeating, the pill is not a solution to any hormonal imbalance issue. It is not a solution to missed or lack of periods or what's called amenorrhea. It's not a solution to endometriosis. It's not a solution to period pains, to acne. I mean, it's not a solution to anything, because the pill will shut down. It's like, you know, the term that I always use in my lectures that gets people's attention is, it's called castration. We are castrating women. We're shutting off, taking their ovaries offline. Now we're controlled by two drugs that, by the way, happen to be carcinogenic and labeled as known human carcinogens. And, by the way, those two types of estrogens and progestins also deplete the body of all these key nutrients like vitamin C and vitamin E and magnesium and zinc and selenium. And by the way, they act like an antibiotic, upsetting the gut flora. And the list can go on. And we, in our insanity, think that they are helping to regulate periods or helping women to get hormonally balanced. How insane is that, Nat?
It's so frustrating. Because we and it's not, you know, we trust our, very often women trust their GP, and unfortunately it's not even necessarily their GP's fault. Obviously they're led to believe that it's safe. They're led to think that it's the solution. And, you know, we're seeing a new wave, obviously, of awareness come through with this, because it's obviously not the case. And I don't necessarily think we can blame our GP. What I get upset about, though, is that our GP is not necessarily able to give advice around this, yet that's our first point of call, and that's a danger as far as I'm concerned. You know, we don't look into anything else, like you said. We don't look into all of these other things that might be contributing. We're led to believe that there is a solution, and that is the pill, and not to worry, because when you're ready to have children, we'll just prescribe you with Clomid and it'll be all happy days. But, you know, like we've discussed, it's this massive knock-on effect, and it's going to affect you right through, you know, into your transition through menopause and beyond. And so we have to get clued up on this stuff now, to be able to make a change, but also to be able to protect our you know, future generations, because this problem isn't getting any better. It's only going to get worse if we don't continue to speak up.
Well, it is getting worse. I mean, more women are suffering. I, you know, just want to let everyone know, if you have a diagnosis of endometriosis, you suffer with really intense menstrual cramps, pain, you know, gut distress. I mean, this is torturous for many women. It can be absolutely debilitating on a monthly basis.
It can. In my experience, though, I find that with the right treatment, you know, 9 times out of 10, women respond really well.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think it's very encouraging to learn that. And so, you know, I think it is about starting again, same with any hormone imbalance or any condition. It's, again, it's what you do on a day-to-day basis. But I think what you touched on before, and just with food, you know, we know that there is a relationship between those inflammatory foods and those toxic foods, especially things like meat and dairy and anything that's going to cause that inflammation. And I'm not saying not to have meat. We need to just be smart about how we're eating it and where it's coming from, because there's a lot of hormones and a lot of toxins within conventional products. And this is, again, why we need to move towards those hormone-free and organic and grass-fed free-range, you know, sources where they can give our bodies the nutrients that they require. Again, you know, the other thing that I tend to see a lot with endometriosis is that women have very often living a vegan lifestyle. And for me, that's a disaster for hormones.
Can you elaborate on that? That's a really important point. Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to vegans, obviously not having any animal products or meat and things like that, it's all plant-based. There are certain nutrients, amino acids, certain things contained, especially in quality meat, that are essential for balancing hormones. And, you know, from a perspective, an energetic perspective even, I find that, you know, the nutrients and the warming energy that these types of foods have are so important for hormone health across the board. Women I tend to see that are vegans in the clinic, they just don't, they're not getting the nutrients that their body needs to build healthy hormones. And look, I say this to women, and it's a bit of a touchy subject, because when it comes to vegans, I feel like, you know, it's kind of us against them, and it shouldn't be like that. And it's not to say some women don't thrive with more plants in their diet, but if you are experiencing hormone imbalance in any way, shape or form, and you are a vegan, it's time to reconsider what you're doing to your body. If you're a vegan and your body's thriving and you have energy when you wake up in the morning, and your menstrual cycles are very regular, and your digestive system is great, and you move your bowels every day, and everything's going and working for you, then that's working for you. But I think the problem is we go along liking the idea of something, yet it doesn't actually support our health. So, you know, I might not function great with copious amounts of meat, but I definitely need meat in my diet to thrive. So it's just a matter of getting clear on, again, what your body needs and where it's at and where the nutrient deficiencies are at and what they are, so that you can utilize your diet to support your health. But I find with 9 times out of 10 with vegans that walk in my clinic, they need to start incorporating bone broth in their diet. And you know, and we're not asking them to eat a cow. We're not asking them to sit down every night and eat a whole animal. But it's just regularly having these food sources in the diet that are very important to balance hormones.
Yeah, you know, I think we often do not understand the importance of protein in our diet. Protein is a source of a building block for our hormones, for our enzymes, for, of course, tissues and muscle. Mm. And without adequate and complete forms of protein, the body just cannot rebuild and regenerate, and that's where we get into trouble. So theories are great, as you know, you were saying, but you actually cannot. You have to listen to your body. And I guess I say that because I was a vegetarian for many years, I think about 20 mm-hmm. years, and I was not a particularly educated vegetarian. Mm. I don't think I was very healthy either from my vegetarian diet. And it was, you know, a real revelation for me when I started to understand more about my body and what it really needed. And I had to be willing to change because my body was talking to me. You're not feeling well. You have symptoms, something needs attention, and you want to really start with your diet.
Absolutely. And, you know, the amount of women that we get eventually to transition over to just starting with adding broth, that's where I get women to start, because I can understand it's very confronting to eat a piece of meat when you haven't done that for a very long time. And a lot often I get that there's an ethical perspective, but what I encourage these women to look at it in the sense of, they're eating the parts of the animal that nobody wants. So if you're making up a big batch of broth with your bones, that's the bit that generally get discarded. And you know, I find that that's one way of enrolling women into that idea, and they get comfortable with that. And the one thing that I find happens very quickly after doing that is they start to get what they would describe as activity in their abdomen. And they really feel it starting to work. And I love that, because if you can, again, see evidence of something creating a change, then you're going to continue to do that. And so I think it's just a matter of being open and trying things on to really try and see where that leads you. But, you know, you have to be open otherwise. And, you know, and I'll say to women, look, we can try, but if we don't get and see changes that I want to see within the next 6 weeks, then we're going to have this conversation again. And, you know, it's about, obviously, you have to be comfortable in doing something, which can be very overwhelming. And I mean, maybe comfortable is not the right word. It can be scary, but if it feels like it resonates or that there's an element of curiosity about it, then I would encourage women to give it a go.
Right. Great advice.
I think the other thing too with that is, just to touch on it, is, you know, it's tricky because the vegan community is quite a tight-knit community, and it can be a bit confronting when you are thinking about moving outside of what everybody else that you know is doing. But I think when it comes to your health, you have to consider what your body is asking for.
Right. It's always so interesting how we create these choices in diet as dogma. They become dogma. And then if you challenge it, you're ostracized and you're attacked. It's like any orthodoxy. It's crazy, isn't it? It's like you have to listen to your body. You have to change. You have to be flexible. You have to be open.
Absolutely. I mean, I get a lot of flack for advocating for young women to not be on the pill, as I'm sure you do too. But let's think about the facts. And I say to especially for young women, so, you know, I've been going into schools and educating in schools as of late, and that's been an amazing experience, I have to say. But the one thing I get from the parents and the mothers is, I think that you're being completely irresponsible in suggesting that my 16-year-old should not be on the pill. And I say, well, I think that if your 16-year-old isn't using condoms as protection against STDs, then that's a really big problem. And that's, you know, so we love to find a reason or an excuse as to why something might be fine to do, even if, you know, there's also that you know, that element of, oh, this might not feel good. I'm gonna go with what makes it feel okay for me. But I think we have to get the facts. We have to get the information. There's a lot of issues that stem from things like STDs, from young women not using condoms. I know that's slightly off track, but I think it's very important.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation. The pill does
totally
not
is.
Protect you from sexually transmitted diseases, you know. So,
which again, Cheryl, can lead to these conditions, or worse than these conditions. You know, I've had the experience of being in surgery and seeing what these STDs can actually do when looking at a laparoscopy, and it's very concerning.
Yeah, and of course become a driving factor for cervical dysplasia.
Yeah.
Which can lead to cervical cancer and infertility issues. Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our show now. You know, it's a great conversation, and you and I can go on and on about this because it's our favorite topics. But I want everyone to know about your website. So is the best website natkringoudis.com.au? Is that your preferred? I know you've got a couple.
That
okay,
is.
So for people who want to know more about Nat's work and her books and blog and great information, radio show, podcast, go to natkringoudis, K-R-I-N-G-O-U-D-I-S, kringoudis.com.au. A good Greek name, right?
Yes, good Greek name.
So Nat Kringoudis, go ahead.
Yeah. Our new book, Well and Good, is available as an ebook on there as well now. It's published here in Australia, but it's also available where I talk through all types of hormone imbalance. And I think what's important to say just as we wrap is that all of these things are a result of, obviously, imbalanced hormones. When we pare it all back and remove the labels and remove everything, it's about rebalancing your hormones to work properly. So Well and Good is our new and latest published book that has basically it's just aimed at women to get clued up on their hormones as to what they need from a diet and lifestyle perspective. So, you know, it also has around 40 recipes in there as well, as long as all the information to kind of give you what you need if you've been diagnosed with something like PCOS, endo, infertility, all those sorts of things.
Fantastic. Well, I so appreciate you taking your time all the way from Melbourne, Australia to be with us today, Nat. And, you know, I just wish you the best with all the great work you're doing. I'm so glad you're going into schools and educating young women. That's where
Thanks, Cheryl.
Need to be doing a lot of work. And, and all the best to you, Nat, and all the great projects you have. Thanks so much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
You're very welcome. And to all of you listening, thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to get empowered with truthful information. You've been listening to What Women Must Know. I'm Dr. Cheryl Selman. We've had Nat Kringoudis today as our guest. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.